That reading from Isaiah 62 is about God's delight, God's pleasure in all of us. They were words spoken to Israel, and Israel was down and out in a tough spot, and they needed to hear that God rejoiced in them, and you need to hear that God rejoices in us. I don't know what got you here today, but I hope now that you're here, that what you feel is that the only reason you're here is because God delights in you. God takes great pleasure in you. And the second reading is along the same lines. From John 2. On the third day, a wedding took place in Cana in Galilee. It's a little place, 10 miles north of Jerusalem. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He didn't realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you've saved the best till now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Now may God bless the reading of Holy Scripture. John's gospel places the story of Jesus turning water into wine at the very front of the gospel. It's the first of several signs that form the framework of the way John's gospel relates the story of Jesus. So, what is it that we can learn from this first sign that invites us to witness the revelation of Jesus' glory and to put our faith in him too? Well, beginnings matter. Any school teacher knows that the first day of school sets the tone for the whole year. You don't plan day one of school to be filled with recess, snacks, and a chaotic free-for-all in the classroom where the children are welcome to run with scissors. No, you want day one to help the kids imagine what the learning environment will be like for the rest of the year. Beginnings are important. Anyone who builds houses knows that the early stages of the build are the most important. If you build the whole house before you ever figure out where exactly the house is supposed to sit on the lot, or if you build out that beautiful custom kitchen before ever putting the roof on the house, well, you're not a very good house builder. Beginnings matter. This sign of Jesus turning the water into wine is designed to bring you and me as hearers into a situation of trust and transformation. By turning water into wine at Cana, Jesus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their trust in him. Verse 11. Now it's important to remember that this sign and other signs that Jesus performed weren't magic. They won't hypnotize you and they won't manipulate you. In other words, these signs don't automatically work on everyone. Some there were back then and some there are here today who will witness the sign and walk away unimpressed and unchanged. But for some others, this sign will be one way that God draws us into the joyful life that Jesus makes possible for all of us, life at the feast. As the first of Jesus' public signs, you'd think, or I'd think at least, that Jesus would have planned something, would have thought about this ahead of time. You'd think he would have been purposeful, would have chosen a particular time and a particular place and some particular something that he would have done to reveal his glory. So it's a little strange to me that Jesus is pictured here as reluctantly agreeing to even get involved. It's almost as if his mother has to twist his arm to get him to jump in and fix the problem. Quote, when the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, they have no more wine. Verse 3. It's really Jesus' mother, as you read this story, who grabs the bull by the horns and tries to get things going. He doesn't want to be involved. My time has not yet come, he says. Did he not want the attention that this public, very public act might bring to him? Did he have some other plan for how he wanted to begin his public ministry? I don't know. Maybe this was his day off. Regardless, his mother, who never is named in this gospel, just his mother, undeterred, tells the servants to do whatever he tells them to do. Well, what he tells them to do is to fill those big 6 stone water pots to the brim with water. Now, this was no small feat. This would have taken a while to do. Each pot, we're told, contained 20 to 30 gallons. So Jesus asked them to prepare 120 to 180 gallons of water. So his initial winemaking project is no small home brewing affair. When I started brewing beer at home, it was in 5-gallon batches. So this is much larger scale. He's going in full tilt and making a batch that will be more than enough to supply the needs of this wedding party. And already we can begin to see that God is inviting us through this sign into a life of celebration, a life of joy, a life of feasting where there's plenty for everyone. When you read the Bible, you will note that plentiful wine and abundant food are signs of God's blessing. When God draws near to us, there will be festive celebration, merriment, laughter, dancing, delight, and lots to eat and drink. So let me ask you this morning, is that what faith feels like for you? Is that who God is for you? Is that what belonging to a church family feels like to you? To share in the worship and the work of a group of people? All of us need to ask ourselves today whether we have opened our lives to a new kind of festivity and joy, and that's what's transforming us, or on the other hand, whether we're here but we're currently settling for something more drab and downbeat and far less fun. Turning water into wine is impressive, of course, but still, you could argue that it appears to be, I don't know, a rather low-level miracle. After all, we know by just reading the other Gospels that there were lots of other very powerful and impressive things that Jesus did. Some of them were much more dramatic, like when he commanded demons to come out of someone's life, an exorcism. Some other of his deeds were more clearly compassionate and merciful, like when he healed women in pain or healed children of terrible diseases. Some of his deeds were more obviously and transparently spiritual, like that time when he healed the paralytic man that was lowered down through the roof, and at the very same time that he healed him said that his sins had been forgiven. But instead of the dramatic, the compassionate, or the spiritual, John's gospel introduces us to Jesus by this story of Jesus changing water into wine at a wedding party. So what was it that got your attention when we read that story? Is it Mary's meddling? Or Jesus' initial unwillingness to get involved and help? Was it the poor planning on the part of the groom's family and the shame they must have felt when the wine ran out too early? Or did you notice that according to John's gospel, our eyes only now begin to adjust to the light of Jesus' glory at a party where the wine flows freely? Do we perhaps smile as it dawns on us that today, at least, We're not being called to follow a lonely, suffering, sad Jesus who has shuffled off by himself to pray. Is there some flicker of relief that passes over our face when we realize that Jesus' coming out party happened with crowds of people who were laughing and dancing and singing? And does that call to some deep hope in us that that's the life that God wants for you and for me? I'll tell you one thing that I noticed. I noticed that Jesus makes good wine. There's cheap wine. We all know that. I've had a lot of it. And there's good wine. When Jesus turns water into wine, it's the good stuff. Trust me, as someone who's tried to brew beer, I appreciate this attention to quality on Jesus' part. It would have been a very, very different party and a very different story in John's gospel had the banquet master tasted the wine and then immediately spit it out, right? If you've ever ordered a cocktail in an upscale bar in the city, you know that it could easily cost you 4 or 5 Bud Lights. If you've ever tried to secure a rare release of a beer like Goose Island's Bourbon County Stout, as some unnamed folks in this building have, you know that you can easily pay $30 for that one stupid bottle of beer. If you've ever looked at a wine list in a nice restaurant, you know that you can pay about as much as you can imagine for a good bottle of wine. We once had dinner with, in New York, this was a mistake by the way, with friends who were from Columbia. She was a chef and he was a finance guy and apparently an amateur sommelier. And so he took charge of ordering at each point in the meal just the right wine to pair with what we were being served. And while that evening was fun, I think this guy had very little experience, as I have, picking wines from the under $10 bin. I think I've confessed this particular sin to you before, but I once paid $200 for a bottle of beer. Now let me defend myself quickly. This was no ordinary beer. It was a beer released only every other year. Can you hear how defensive this sounds already? Only every other year by Sam Adams Brewing in Boston. This was a limited release, small batch beer that Sam Adams calls their Utopia series. It's aged in bourbon barrels for years. They only release 13,000 bottles of this every other year. So they're difficult to get your hands on. Most light beers are around 3 or 4% alcohol by volume. The strongest beers you can get are maybe 8 or 9%. The Utopia is 28% alcohol by volume. That's so unusual for something called beer that it's actually illegal to sell in 15 states. That's also why Sam Adams' website bills Utopia as, quote, reminiscent of a rich vintage port, old cognac, or fine sherry with notes of dark fruit, subtle sweetness, and a deep, rich, malty smoothness, end quote. There you go. Now, lest you all think that I am a spendthrift, I want you to know that there were 4 of us who went in on this bottle of beer together, so it only cost each of us $50. And as long as I don't think too hard about other things I could have done with $50, I'd say the experience was well worth it. Archaeologists tell us that there were about 100 different varieties of grapes that were unique to the region of Palestine during Jesus' day. There were probably around 6 of those 100 varieties that were suitable for winemaking. Ancient Israel was actually a winemaking region and exported much of its wine throughout the rest of the Roman Empire. Most of it, archaeologists say, would have been red wine due to the grapes grown in the area. Making good wine back then, even drinkable wine, was not an easy affair. Wine presses were made of stone, built near the vineyard. The grapes were harvested and dumped into the wine press. And here's where it gets good. Someone takes off their sandals, jumps into the wine press, and starts stomping the grapes, keeping their balance by holding on to ropes that were above the wine press. So that's right. The winemaking process began with other people's bare feet. That's enough to make teetotalers out of some of us. The juice ran out of the press into storage vats. In cool storage, the wine would then naturally ferment. The yeast that was found on the grape skins would eat the natural sugars in the grapes, producing alcohol. There's lots of debates about how high in alcohol content these ancient wines would have been, but we do know that they must have been fairly strong because it was a common ancient practice to always dilute wine, even at a fancy party, to dilute it with water to make it more easier drinking. The goal for winemakers was to make enough wine to last the whole year until next year's grape harvest. Generally, the alcohol in the wine killed any harmful bacteria, so Bob's right. Wine was safer to drink than water. But over time, that wine towards the end of the year could get a little funky. And so it was very common to add other stuff, tree resin, peppers, capers, other stuff to kind of mask and cover up the funky flavors. Cheaper wines that you drank in the ancient world were unfiltered. So it was common to have a few bits or chunks or grape skins in your wine. If wines were filtered at all, they were filtered through cloth or sometimes through pigeon droppings. I don't know about you, but if I've got to choose between wine with pulp and wine that's been filtered through pigeon droppings, I'll take the pulp. When the banquet master in the story tastes the water that's been turned into wine, he's surprised that the host has held back such delicious wine for the final hours of the feast. That sense of surprise on his part can be ours as well today as we begin to ponder the gracious abundance of God, the lavish and excessive generosity that marks God's way of being with us and calling us into this life together. Yes, plentiful wine and lots of food are always signs of God's blessing. And yet we all know of places around the world right now with no clean water and not nearly enough food. We wouldn't have to walk far from this room in which we're sitting right now to find homes with no electricity and no running water, right? So this story about God's lavish provision raises worries about why, if God is so generous, there's still so much scarcity in the world all around us. What about the folks in Flint, Michigan, who still can't drink their water? What about the people in Puerto Rico still trying to rebuild after a devastating hurricane? What about refugee cities around the world filled with thousands and thousands of people fleeing war, violence, and living in tents? What about those seeking asylum at our own borders, desperate for the safety for their own children? Surely all those who are poor, distressed, and in pain would warn you and me about hearing this story today and celebrating God's abundance too quickly or too easily. They would remind us that the feast becomes a true feast only as all of us, you and me, together share the food and the wine with everyone. One of the commentaries I read on this passage quoted Robert Hotchkiss, quote, Christians, he says, Christians ought to be celebrating constantly. We ought to be preoccupied with parties, banquets, feasts, and merriment. We ought to give ourselves over to veritable orgies of joy because we have been liberated from the fear of life and from the fear of death. We ought to attract, get this line, we ought to attract people to the church quite literally by the fun there is in being Christian. I think he's right. Part of what draws you and me to the glory of Jesus Christ is the joy we find in this new way of life, the joy we find in sharing our lives with other people, and that will be what draws other people to this same Jesus. If this story reawakens all of us to the importance of feasting and joy, it also awakens us to this strange reversal of the way God does things. This is a new kind of feasting, a new kind of joy. It's not tied to the economy or to your wealth or to your status or to your possessions, to your success. This is not a feast for those who are healthy, happy, and strong. This is a feast in which the best wine, the most expensive wine, was brought out at the very end. What used to be at the front is now at the back of the line. And here, friends, we see the upending and the reversal of our wider cultural assessment of joy and parties and feasting. So let's remember this. Our church is at its best when we celebrate intensely and celebrate. Often our church is at its best when all of our celebrations include those who are poor, those who are sick, those who are in need, those who are in pain. Our church is at its best when we're learning together to share our meals and our money with those who have little reason to rejoice. Our church is best when we reach out and welcome all those who have experienced failure, frustration, and rejection And when we welcome them into the party that God's throwing for everyone who's looking for a new way to live and new friends to live it with. In fact, though, our day of worship today, I think, is a good expression of the tension in which we all live. Following our worship in just a few minutes, we'll have this congregational meeting. Don't get too excited about this, right? A congregational meeting in which we kind of have to do the business of being a church together. It's the nuts and bolts stuff. It's the how the sausage gets made part of church life, right? But after that, then we'll move downstairs for a chili cook-off where people have brought food to share and others will share their money with our kids as they get ready to go on mission trips. In everything we do, let's make sure that we're living with joy, in a joy that welcomes all others into the life that God makes possible for us in Jesus Christ.